A newly published UW-Madison study may help understand how some plants withstand drought. Scientists say that knowledge could be timely if climate change makes some parts of the world hotter and drier. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Scientists have known for decades that a hormone called abscisic acid has helped some plants survive excessive cold, radiation, and dehydration. A UW laboratory team has used high-tech instruments to identify which set of plant proteins, about 50 of them, the hormone activates. Joining us to talk about their work on plants and the implications for world agriculture are the three authors of the groundbreaking UW study getting so much international attention. UW-Madison biochemistry professor Michael Sussman, along with postdoctoral fellow Kelly Klein and staff scientist Gregory Barrett-Wilt.
Welcome, one and all, to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you here. Whenever we hear of something so apparently specialized like the work you're doing, I have to wonder, how do you get onto this in the first place?
Well, it takes about $2 million worth of sophisticated instruments, funding from the government, and brilliant co-workers like the people that are here right now. This is actually one of those interdisciplinary projects because the technology to do this kind of work is very sophisticated. It requires mass spectrometry, knowledge of all the intricacies of that chemical instruments, and then applying that to the right piece of biology is kind of extremely important.
Where does the original impetus come from, though? I mean, does it come from the funder? Does it come from you, the scientists? Does it come from industry?
I'm a professor. I wrote the grant, actually the grant with Greg's help. Dr. Barrett-Wilt came to my lab about 4 or 5 years ago from a company in California that was doing a lot of mass spectrometry, and his thesis was in mass spectrometry. My thesis was in plant biology, but I've been learning bit by bit over the past 5 or 10 years as much as I could, enough to get into trouble, I guess. But I knew I couldn't do it, so Greg came first, and then we were fortunate in getting funding from the National Science Foundation to purchase a state-of-the-art instrument that he can tell you more about called an Orbitrap. And then about a year ago, I was very fortunate to have Dr. Klein, Kelly, approach me about doing a postdoc in my lab. She had previously worked in an animal lab, but again, she's a mass spectrometrist.
Plants, animals.
Mm-hmm. To explain what mass spectrometry is.
When I give lectures, people that don't know it, I simply say it's a very, very expensive and fancy instrument that measures the weight of molecules. And it's been around for actually 30, 40 years, getting better and better. And in the field of biology, now we call it proteomics or metabolomics. Those follow on the heels of the DNA sequencing revolution. Turns out that even though DNA is important, it's actually the proteins and the small molecules in the cell that do all the work. And what we really need to do is measure the proteins and the small molecules, not just sequence their genome. And so that's what we do. We study the proteins and the small molecules with mass spectrometers.
So did the real impetus come from this concept of developing more drought-resistant plants? Is that where the idea came from, or what was your approach?
In the beginning, we were studying, I think the very first experiment that Greg did was to study the effect of agents that mimic drought in the laboratory. We add a large amount of salt to a plant, and that basically starts the whole dehydration process going. And that's plants respond to the salt as if it's a drought. And Greg's expertise in terms of running the mass spectrometer and protein work developed a method of measuring a particular modification of proteins known as phosphorylation. All organisms add modify proteins by adding a phosphate to certain amino acids in those proteins. And it took 2-3 years.
Very long time.
Can you tell us about the work and what you did?
Well, I think the one of the answers to the question is that obviously Mike's lab is a plant lab, so there's a vast body of experience in working with plants. And the people have been looking for the receptor for abscisic acid, ABA, for a long time. And last year, finally, there was success in the discovery of the receptor. Sort of concurrently with that, I was in Mike's lab working on trying to get our technology platform up and running. And at about the same time that the technology platform sort of got solved, Kelly showed up And the first thing that she did was to apply abscisic acid to plants, and in conjunction with the recent discovery of the receptor, everything really came together nicely. And so I sort of provided some of the technology, and then she just took that and produced this phenomenal data that sort of unlocked all of these interesting findings.
So tell us about this acid. I've never heard of abscisic acid.
Abscisic acid is actually a natural phytohormone that
when
plants...
Okay, back it up, phytohormone.
So a natural hormone that affects plants. So that's called a phytohormone or a plant hormone. And it's found in nature. And when plants are actually come in contact with ABA or abscisic acid, it's a little bit easier just to call it ABA. When they come in contact with ABA, it actually causes them to go dormant. And so they can survive in these very high drought conditions by just going dormant and not necessarily growing anymore so that they don't completely desiccate and die. And so our idea was, if we could understand the natural process of ABA signaling in a plant, then we could sort of extrapolate from that and try to understand ways in which we could then engineer plants to respond to it more or to have the same response as if they were treated with ABA, so that we could have these more drought-resistant plants. But it all comes back to the very initial work is, what is it doing out there in nature, and mm-hmm. how can we understand it?
And do all plants have ABA?
Yeah, yes. I would want to expand a little bit on that. Abscisic acid was discovered, I think, 40 years ago, and it's, as Kelly says, it's plays a major role in helping the plant resist drought in the vegetative part. Now, plants have another life in the seed. And one of the most remarkable things about plants and certain animals, like brine shrimp and a few others, they can actually take their cells, which are normally 95% water, like we all are.
They go down to what, about 90?
90. And they can go down to 10%.
10%.
So a seed, a corn seed or a soybean, those are all 10% water. But those cells are still alive. Now, a vegetative part of the plant can't drop below 70 or 80%. That's called a permanent wilting point. And I know I've killed many plants at home.
That's the black thumb point.
But the amazing thing is that because we know seeds can do it, then the information in the genome on how to survive 10% water is there. But most or all plants that we normally come in contact with can't do that in the vegetative. There are some plants, such as the resurrection plant, which grows in the deserts, that actually can go down to 10% water. And some people are studying that plant. But the approach we take is we have a model plant called Arabidopsis that is like the white rat. And Kelly latched onto it. It's the organism we all study in our lab.
Is this the one that's a little like a cabbage?
Right, yeah. Right. Mustard.
Right. In the mustard family, related to broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower.
And what's unique about it? What makes it special?
Three things. First of all, it happens to have a tiny genome. So the amount of DNA, and we don't know why, corn has 30 times the amount of DNA as Arabidopsis, and it's all like really weird DNA. It's very repetitive, and it's not clear what it's doing.
So this is a dumb plant?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. It grows pretty well, though. So that was actually really – and Arabidopsis was the first plant genome sequenced to the tune of $200 million that the National Science Foundation and the U.S. led that worldwide effort to sequence Arabidopsis. It's really carefully done, which is good. And then it also goes from seed to seed quickly, like within 2 months. See, corn, it's not that quick. Corn, you know, you need a year or 6 months minimum. And also it's small. So we can do real genetics. We can actually screen 30,000 seeds on a table about the size, a dining room table, and screen hundreds of thousands of seeds and find the mutants that you want, and then quickly find the genes that are causing the mutant phenotypes. So it's genetically, it's been a wonderful organism. But the technology that Kelly and Greg are very familiar with and helped develop has not been applied in plants as well as it has been in the medical world. And so the work we did was really a fundamental basic research and is the first of many types of pieces of biology in plants that we'll be applying this technology to.
Now, Kelly, so why did you want to go from animals to plants, though? I mean, you were dealing more in the medical field, and now you're interested in plants?
Yeah, so I actually got my PhD in pharmacology, which is drug development. I worked on cardiovascular drugs at the University of Colorado Health Science Center before coming here. And I was actually drawn to plants for the diversity of my education in terms of being able to learn more basic genetics. And so it brought me to Mike's lab to learn plant genetics and to work with a model system where you could do genetics so well, and also to work with really high-tech instrumentation such as the Orbitrap mass spectrometer, and to be able to do these kinds of experiments quickly and to publish these kinds of papers that are very interesting and just completely out of the realm of what I had started out doing. So it was a challenge that I liked.
So you're diversifying yourself just the way plants should be diverse to be healthy.
So tell us about this fancy Orba whatever.
The Orbitrap is an instrument produced by Thermo Fisher Scientific. And in my opinion, it's hands down the best piece of equipment to do this kind of work. And trying to explain mass spectrometry is a bit of a challenge because it's a very complex piece of equipment. And the things that we do with it actually are all abstract. You know, you don't see anything. Nothing. We never see the things we're analyzing. We don't see the ions we produce. We can just infer that they're there from the signals we detect, which is kind of interesting.
That's kind of weird. What does the actual thing, the actual instrument look like? Is it a big...
So I'd say it's about the size of a refrigerator box, maybe a little bit larger. And this particular instrument is actually a hybrid, so it's got two parts. The one part is one kind of mass spectrometer. That device is very good at sequencing the things that we're interested in studying, which are proteins and peptides, and finding these places where they've been modified, which are sort of the pieces of the plant that are making the response to treatment with abscisic acid. And then there's the second mass spectrometer all inside this one box, which has the features of being able to measure the masses of these peptides with very high accuracy, very high precision, and sort of most significantly in our work, very high dynamic range. So we can measure the abundances and measure the identities of these signaling molecules, these peptides, in the presence of a background of uninteresting but extremely highly abundant materials. So the dynamic range of the instrument is in excess of 2,000 to 1. So we have stuff that's huge and not at all interesting. But in that background, we can find stuff that's very minute but highly interesting and still get information about it.
I should add, on the technology side, Greg spent a number of years in the lab developing a really neat way of doing this experiment of quantifying these proteins. And that is, we have an untreated plant, and then we have a plant that's been treated with abscisic acid. But the difference between those two is one is labeled with normal nitrogen, which is N14 isotope, and the other one is labeled with N15. Now, N15 is non-radioactive. It's perfectly innocuous. It's very safe. And the reason we do it is that we can then grind up the two plants together. And then when we isolate the protein and inject the protein at the mass spectrometer separates the protein from the treated from the untreated because they have different N14 versus N15. And then in the same exact window and experiment, we can actually quantify that protein as it's been treated by ABA. And the same technology, we previously published a paper also in PNAS by a grad student and a postdoc in my lab previously, where we did the same thing with mice. We actually grew a mouse where almost every nitrogen atom in its body had an extra neutron. So the only difference is N15
and that's what makes it. That's what makes it N15 versus N14 is the presence of this extra neutron in the nucleus.
Right. And just out of curiosity, how did this mouse differ from any other mouse that was N14?
It didn't look any different. It didn't seem to behave any different. As I said, it's remarkable. Many organisms now we've done this in, these are very stable isotopes. And in fact, in the clinical world, these isotopes being used in humans routinely, they're non-radioactive and they have very little effect. The surprising thing is that we can go up to 90% or more. In other words, we can replace practically every nitrogen with this heavier element. And in fact, and we've also done this with C13 in plants. We've created a plant that actually had both C13 and N15. And I would love to try that with a mouse because you would predict the mouse would actually be a little heavier.
How would you, just to play devil's advocate, how would you answer if somebody says, well, you're messing with Mother Nature, you're being Dr. Frankenstein, what are you doing with our plants and animals if you're altering the genetic material here, and what's the purpose?
Well, I'm very sensitive to that. That's an extremely important point I'm very happy you raised. I love nature. I view organisms as nature's gift, the odd organisms especially. The octopus that walks on the bottom of the sea. They just found a four-legged fish.
Yes, right, in deep water.
Mm-hmm. Electric fish. I think we can now use our genomics to understand at a chemical level exactly how these organisms do these marvelous things they do. Then we can either mimic those using physics, as many people Velcro coming from the ability of insects to climb walls, or we can use genetics to modify these organisms. And also, that knowledge can also be used in medicine to help either develop new drugs or use modern molecular genetics to help with us as well. But all of this has to be done carefully and one step at a time. I know that transgenic plants, some people are quite afraid of that. And I think we need to go very carefully, very slowly, and take it one step along each way and see, are they safe, are they not? Agriculture itself is based on genetic modification. In fact, breeders are manipulating genes all over the place.
Sure.
And potatoes breeders will take a potato from Peru and cross it into modern potatoes. And within 3 years, you're eating the potatoes that have a pathogen resistance. What you don't realize is that you also have these other 500 genes coming along with it. In transgenics, we only do one gene at a time that has been very carefully studied. And in some ways, you could argue it's even safer to do that. But you are monkeying with the basic tools of nature. We want to be very careful about the release of these organisms. You want to be very careful that we're not doing anything deleterious at all. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
But just to be clear for our experiments here, what we're actually doing is we're not altering the genetic material of these plants.
Right.
So when we're talking about transgenic plants, that is in no way what we're doing in these experiments. What we're doing is just growing the plants in a media where they're bringing up through their roots a different type of salt that has one extra neutron in its nitrogen. So we're not altering genetic codes. We're not creating transgenic plants. We're just growing them in a different type of media.
Right.
I'm also director of the Biotechnology Center in addition to being a professor in biochemistry. So I'm on the carnivore. I'm a little more sensitive. But Kelly's absolutely right. This is pure basic research.
Right.
We're simply figuring out at the most basic level how the molecules of a plant operate.
So I think that concerns about transgenics and modifying the genomes of plants and crops and so forth, that's down the road quite a ways. First, we have to figure out what the genes are, what the proteins are that are important, then start to tease apart, how they play their different roles, then see what kinds of modifications can be made to those genes to potentially improve how they respond to drought. So it's a long process, and it has to start with these kinds of discovery experiments. And that's where we are, getting from here to a plant that grows, on vastly less water and so forth. That's a long process.
What happens when we push this button?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that have to be done very carefully and doing those experiments, growing those plants and seeing what the effects are. That's when you
So what do you learn careful. From a heavy carbon, heavy nitrogen mouse then? What would you learn?
It's the same basic experiment and design, but there we were studying colon cancer. The mutant mouse that we were comparing to wild type in terms of the protein in the blood gets colon cancer within about 9 months. It's a wonderful model system for human cancer and was developed by a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Professor Bill Dove. And I viewed it as an incredible opportunity to do something important, which is basically eliminate colonoscopies.
Because there'd be a lot of people who would be grateful for that.
I realize that. And also, as I'm getting older, I do too. So, and in fact, it's a very similar experiment to what we did with the plant in that we are now looking for a protein which changes its level as a function of onset of colon cancer. So again, we take the mutant mouse, an N14, and the wild type, an N15, and or vice versa. And again, we take blood from them both, and we isolate the protein in one tube, and then we inject that, and we're looking now for N14 or N15 peaks that are now altered. And those are very good candidates for biomarkers for colon cancer. So we're looking for things that happen early in that mutant mouse before it gets colon cancer that predict colon cancer before the symptoms appear. So, this same technology is very applicable to both agriculture and medicine.
So just at a very basic level, the whole idea of labeling one set of animals or plants in the 15N versus the 14N is just so when we're looking at it on the mass spectrometer that we can distinguish between what population it came from. So if we're looking at a plant population that hasn't been treated at all, that's been in 14N media, and then we have our abscisic acid treated plant that's been in 15N media, we can now distinguish between those two populations in the mass spec because they're going to weigh different amounts.
Right.
So it's just a really interesting biochemical way in order for us to distinguish between those two things. And as Mike said, it works also in animals. You know, people have done it in rats and in mice. And it's just a really clever way in order to distinguish between those two populations.
You know, in the past, we used to do those experiments with radioactive isotopes. But the nice thing about the mass spectrometers is you can don't have to do that anymore. You can work with these very safe, stable isotopes. The machine's able to separate very nicely. And many labs that used to use isotopes are no longer in many aspects of genomics.
Do they just – this machine, does it just come out with a printout?
The data is collected so fast. You can't do it without high-speed computers. And the things that we see, the thing that I was referring to, where we can infer the presence of these species – is just signals on the computer screen. You know, the thing that makes all of this N14, N15 technology work is that what those isotopes do is change the weight of our analytes, the things that we're looking for. And the tool that we use to look for those things is a mass spectrometer, that thing that measures weight. So we see these as pairs of signals, just essentially stick plots or bar graphs on a screen. And we know that these signals correspond to peptides that arose from either the N14 or N15 organism. And we have our control and we have our experimental. We look for cases that show significant abundance differences between the N14 and the N15 signals. And those then are peptides, proteins that have been significantly influenced by our treatment, either the mutation in the mouse or the abscisic acid treatment in the plant.
And we'll find out how it applies to drought-resistant plants when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. And our three guests this hour are Michael Sussman, Kelly Klein, and Gregory Barrett-Wilt. We're talking about their work on drought-resistant plants in the laboratory using high-tech equipment. Let's take it back to the sort of global picture. I know you're working with very fine-tuned molecular data in a laboratory doing basic research, so you're not out there thinking about how this might affect a place in Africa that is having trouble with famine. But it must cross your mind that the work you're doing could ultimately lead to something that would help with worldwide starvation, for instance. Can you tell us something about the problem that's out there and how you see this work as maybe one link in a chain?
Yeah, and I think it's really important as we're basic researchers to kind of step back every once in a while and say, okay, why are we doing this? Who is this going to impact down the future? And one of the things that drew me into this project was the whole idea that over the next, you know, 10, 20, or 30 years is as our population in the world is growing, we're coming up with these worldwide food shortages. And it's estimated that even in 2009 that there was something like 1.02 billion people out there that have food shortages and are undernourished people within the world. And, you know, you see food riots that break out in Egypt or Indonesia, in Nigeria. And a lot of this, you know, even in Kenya, the corn crops in Kenya in their Rift Valley, they've had 3 years of incredibly erratic rainfall. And they've had something like 95% of their corn crop has completely failed. And so when you think about entire countries that have 95% of their crops failing, you have to wonder what researchers could do in order to help those people be able to cultivate crops even when we have erratic rainfall and these drought conditions. And so that was, in the big picture, one of the things that brought us on to this ABA project. So when we look at a natural phytohormone that might help plants be able to resist death when they don't have enough water, you sort of immediately think of that long-term process of going from that natural hormone. If you can understand how it works, then maybe we'll be able to create these crops that can then still survive when there's no water. And so stepping back from our own research and realizing the big picture is something that we have to do often because we are sort of in the trenches of it.
Mm-hmm. I should add that drought research has been targeted by the National Science Foundation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as well as the Gates Foundation, for substantial increases in funding, because the predictions are that there will be much greater drought as global warming continues, and that it's just a matter of doing the best we can to be ready for that. And I should add another thing on medical versus ag research. There is over $30 billion a year spent in medical research, NIH, places like that. And there's probably less than $1 billion, maybe even $500 million on agricultural research. So we're really so much in the dark ages on how plants work. And I really am thrilled. I often have people in my lab, either at the postdoctoral level or at the graduate level, who have never worked on plants, and I love...
two hands go up here. That's two out of three.
And I love to watch them. Also, they bring a fresh perspective on it. I myself came... I was a postdoc at a medical school out east, and my advisor, when she heard that I was coming to actually move... I was in horticulture before I moved to biochemistry. And she said that I was going from bleeders to breeders.
Well, that could be a pleasant change. I suppose the emphasis would be on crops, food crops. But, and although it's preferable, I'm sure, not to have that plant die during a drought, how does it affect, though, the ripening cycle of the crop if this thing goes into some kind of dormancy?
Plants can't move. You've all noticed that, right?
Except in horror movies.
Right. That's true, right? But the amazing thing is they've actually been evolving for the same length of time as animals. We're talking hundreds of millions of years. Life began about 3.5 billion years ago. And so their mechanisms are much more molecular. They are actually very able to sense changes in their environment very quickly. And so we believe small changes in the ability to sense water changes allow the plant to quickly adapt, and anything we can do to make that even better. And I should give you an example. Previous to when Kelly and Greg worked in my lab, I had another graduate student named Dana Summers who discovered a protein that senses how much water is in the plant. And she was able to make Arabidopsis where that gene was overexpressed or knocked out. The plant with this protein overexpressed was drought resistant, and the plant with it knocked out was drought sensitive. So we showed that this protein is fundamental to sensing drought. So what I'm trying to say is that it's not an all or none thing, that small changes in the ability to sense and respond over a 5 to 10 minute period or a 30 to 60 minute period may have very important effects in the field, because drought doesn't, like, it isn't always 4 days of drought. Sometimes it's like just 1 day of drought. And the plant is sensing at all times how much water is around. And it's extremely complicated. Plants are also exquisitely sensitive to gravity and to the amount of light. And all of these inputs are being integrated into a plant's ability to grow in that particular environment. So it's incredibly, it keeps me up at night. It's so complicated.
Is there any, you know, you had mentioned before that you studied colon cancer in mice or that kind of thing, where you can take an animal model and you'll see that there might be a correspondence to a human condition. With plants, the way they work are so, you know, it's so different. But is there anything in terms of this particular ABA acid where there's a equivalent in human beings or in camels or in something where, you know, something where there is a crossover effect?
I can offer worms. Are they close enough to animals?
Well, we'll count worms.
They must be animals, right?
So they actually, worms have something called dour, where it's a dormancy. And I think there's some really strong, I think there's a desiccation at part of it. Certainly brine shrimp. So we know that, in fact, this is possible in animals because of brine shrimp. And in fact, we may be able to start doing this with other animals. If we can discover chemicals involved in it, we may be able to start creating such a dormant state in animals that don't normally do it. But there are some animals that obviously do it. I know there's a lot of people working at Wisconsin on 13 line squirrels because they actually...
On what?
13 line squirrels.
13 line squirrels, okay.
Those nasty
little ground squirrel type things.
Yeah, uh-huh. This is Professor Hannah Carey, actually one of my grad students. Clark Nelson became her postdoc. And then that squirrel actually burrows down in the winter and drops its body temperature down to 4 degrees for months at a time.
But it's not hibernating? It's just a different...
No, it is.
It is a hibernation.
It's a type of hibernation, which in a way is related to dormancy in plants, believe it or not. But in that state, they're much more resistant to trauma, in fact. You're using this actually with humans now, where people go through a lot of blood loss or something. You bring their body temperature now. And so there's just basic research in this field is really important and impinges on so many things that we don't really know much at all about.
So if we had a cabbage, let's say, that we're growing, and we have a drought-resistant cabbage that we have developed, and we've developed this cabbage by just maybe making a little oversensitive its receptivity or to drought, then if we get through a couple of dry days, that plant, instead of wilting, is just going to go dormant for a couple of days. And if it's a 30-day drought, then what happens?
I mean, all of this is downstream. And again, what we're doing is basic research. And oftentimes, this basic research doesn't work out in the field. We may have a drought-resistant cabbage that tastes awful.
Well, there's that too, of course, yeah.
And nobody wants that. So it's a long-range, you know, getting this actually into practical use is not trivial. But it all starts, though, with identifying these molecules.
But now I think you mentioned at one point that the effect can be very quick, what, 5 or 10 minutes?
Well, we know plants are responding to changes in their environment very quickly. They don't, you know, you don't see it. But let me give you a couple examples. Venus flytrap and Mimosa pudica. Venus flytrap, you know, you touch two of those three hairs within 5 seconds and the damn thing closes. And it's all water-related, actually. The cells that connect the lobes are explosively losing or gaining water. And the turgor change results in the closure because there's no muscles or anything. It's all the same process. The celery loses its water and gets floppy.
Sure.
That turgor is really critical for all plant movements. Mimosa pudica, the touch-sensitive plant, I don't know if you've seen
it. Yeah, sure, you touch it and it kind of curls around your hip finger.
So that's actually an electrical potential, a depolarization along the stem, much like the depolarization in the nerves that connect our brain and our muscles. And in fact, I published about 15 years ago a body of work where we identified a potassium channel in Arabidopsis that is so similar to the same ion channel that works in our brains and probably mediates the movement of that electrical potential when you touch it to where the motion is.
Sounds like you're finding plants in many ways sort of awe-inspiring, just the intricacy of the mechanisms that allow them to adjust.
Yes. And in fact, Kelly mentioned she came from a pharmacology department. I don't know if your listeners know this, but I think over half the drugs that we take to alleviate our daily ills come from a plant. And I believe we've only started to tap the incredible biochemical capabilities. Again, it's the Zen thing. They can't walk away, so they have got
to be very conscious of where they are.
Right. They have to adjust in other ways.
What about your reaction to plants, Kelly? I'm just curious. On a sort of personal level, if you're working with these plants that do all kinds of things and you're studying them, do you ever sort of just respond to the intricacy of it itself?
Yeah, I recently had to purchase my first plant physiology book because I was realizing that I know so little about them. And the mass amounts that you can learn from plants and that come from plants, and particularly for me coming from a pharmacology background, as Mike was saying, the natural products of plants that can be then potentially used in humans as drugs or the targets to then create drugs, I find it just, as you said, awe-inspiring. And it kind of made me think of when you were asking if abscisic acid had any, you know, homologs in humans. And actually, humans do produce ABA in our pancreatic beta cells. And so there have been very few papers, and it still seems to be sort of a new thing. But researchers are starting to look at if abscisic acid can be used in any way to help alleviate diabetes. And so we know that it doesn't work in the same way as in plants. But the idea that the same type of hormone could cross over between plants and animals but work in completely different ways is really interesting to me, and I hope more research goes into that work.
There are instances where you discover something in plants and then it's discovered later in animals. I mean, there's the Nobel Prize went to Barbara McClintock for hopping genes, and it turned out she discovered transposons way before they were identified in any other organ. She got the Nobel Prize for that. In this instance, what the really fascinating thing in our field is this discovery of this receptor protein that Dr. Barrett-Wilt was talking about. It turns out that the receptor that ABA binds to, then together they inhibit a protein phosphatase, which controls this modification of proteins. The reason I'm mentioning that in animals, many of these phosphorylation events are intimately tied to cancer. And usually the oncogenes and cancer-causing things always affect kinases, protein kinases, which are the enzymes that attach a phosphate. There are no examples yet in animals of a naturally occurring hormone affecting this phosphatase, which is taking the phosphate off. And that's what was discovered in plants, this hormone acts through protein phosphatase rather than protein kinase. Many animal people are now re-examining this question because, again, it easily is overlooked. Once you discover something in one example in biology, it then opens the doors for looking in elsewhere, and you find it in places you never expected to
find. I mean, I, for one, don't usually think of hormones and plants at the same time.
Oh.
Sorry.
It's so frustrating because I know over my years of research.
That's okay, me neither.
Do they have hormonal cycles?
Oh, absolutely.
They do?
Oh, yeah. They come. Oh, and in fact, ABA, abscisic acid, is a really good example. So when you get fertilization, the pollen fertilizes the egg, and you get an embryo that develops. That's a wet embryo, just like every other wet plant. And then when ABA level, abscisic acid, goes up, the whole desiccation process starts, and the embryo gets dry and forms a seed. And now that dry seed does not germinate until the ABA level goes down again.
Oh, really?
And so abscisic acid, its cycling controls everything. I just want to add one thing. There's a beautiful mutant in corn known as viviparous, where when you rip open the corn, you pull the leaves off the corn cob, you see seedlings because they never underwent the desiccation. They never went dormant.
Well, and that also would explain why you can open up some pharaoh's tomb and get seeds that will still germinate because they've shut down for that period of time.
And we don't know. It's really fantastic. We don't know how something can last 1,000 years. Plants have discovered this incredible dormancy that does this. And there's no other organism. And we're hoping those secrets we learn from those seeds will be applicable for animal medicine, longevity. It's not inconceivable that the ability to live longer is related to these kind of metabolic changes that dormancy undergoes.
I love your extrapolations.
Human seeds.
It can start sounding like science fiction fairly quickly when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our three guests, Michael Sussman, Gregory Barrett-Wilt, and Kelly Klein, who are experts in one way or the other in this area of developing drought-resistant plants. And it's much more complicated than that, as we have discovered and will continue to discover. But I want to go back to the cabbage patch for a minute here and see if you'll speculate a little bit. If we develop a cabbage that is drought resistant for 3, 4, 5 days, and this we do with the application of this ABA, and this drought goes on for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or a month, as we know it can easily do in some parts of the world, can we then adapt the plants in the field for the further application of this hormone, ABA?
There are people looking at that, but they're also looking at modifications of the abscisic acid molecule, different types of hormone analogs, they're called. And the recent discovery that there are, in fact, 12 receptors, each binding a different type of ABA is a possibility, but that's not what my lab, but the people that discovered the receptor, one in Europe and the other one at UC Riverside, are actively pursuing that issue of, we call it chemical genomics, where you take a library of tens of thousands of small molecules, many of which are related to ABA in structure, and then you start screening to see which one of those molecules has a different effect. In medicine, we're doing that, and I think and also people looking at that for field applications too. You know, you have to be careful of things you spray that they're safe. But it all begins with work in the laboratory on these compounds, finding the right modification of abscisic acid that works for the particular piece of biology that you're interested in, which in this case is drought.
Do all plants have some mechanism that enables them to adjust to drought, so far as we know?
Yeah. So there is a different protein in the plasma membrane, the external part of a plant cell, that senses how much water a plant has. And my lab published on that 8 years ago, where we proved through genetics that this protein plays the fundamental role in sensing how much water is available. When you take this protein and you genetically overexpress it, you create plants that are better able to resist drought. I guess they're finer tuned to the small changes in water availability. And if you knock out that gene, you create plants that are more sensitive to drought, which again is the best genetic evidence that this protein is playing a role in that whole response. But again, we think there might be hundreds of proteins involved. Kelly and Greg discovered 50 new ones that people hadn't considered. Previously, we probably had about 20 that we suspected were involved. So, you know, there's 30,000 genes, 30,000 proteins in the plant, and it's really hard to work with them all. So we've kind of narrowed it down to maybe 50, 60, 70 now, which is good to work with.
I would think that besides helping perhaps with more resistant crops that would help with the hunger problem, that it might be important with erosion, or, you know, if you can have plants that will continue to grow rather than having whole areas of land washed away and so on, that that might also be a side effect of, you know, results.
Well, I'm learning about that firsthand because I actually bought a 20-acre farmette outside of Coarse Plains, and my wife's been growing heritage animals, and we're trying to do it as sustainable as possible. And I now have a tractor that I've learned to drive. And we built what are called swales, which are ways of keeping the rainwater available instead of just running down and eroding. Mm-hmm. I know that's something that's not used in many countries. It's a very simple way of actually helping without any genetics or anything, just make the water better usage. But I also have been learning about some plants have enormous root systems that are fantastic for keeping the soil intact and non-eroding. I think it's a wheat plant has like 30 miles of a single wheat plant. If you add up all the root surface, it's like 30
miles.
Murder
pulling those things up.
And that's how you know.
Tractor.
Well, if each of you would look into, I know scientists like to report results and not speculate, but it's fun to sort of look, I think, ahead too. But if you could try to look, say, 5 years into the future, what would you like to have seen happen in the particular area that you're working, whether it's the use of mass spectrometry in your case, Greg, or just general work in your lab, Michael, or in your case, Kelly, things that you'd like to see as you move from this pharmacology background into this new work in plants? Sort of what would you like in 5 years to have seen in your lab or others that would be really interesting?
So for mass spectrometry, we always want more sensitivity, faster, more results for unit amount of time, or, you know, per unit of input material, and more depth of understanding for what we put into the instrument. And, you know, we have a fairly phenomenal group of technologists on campus that are really driving that forward substantially, very notably a new hire in chemistry department, Josh Kuhn, professor of chemistry, developing and pushing forward new technology that, you know, has the potential to really change how much information we can get out of a single experiment. And, you know, the instrument manufacturers are obviously are keenly interested in doing this. And I would say that in the future, the idea would be that we can have results coming back more in real time with greater significance, greater biological significance at greater sensitivity. So the idea would be that, you know, now when we do one of these experiments, we put in milligrams worth of ground-up plant tissue and go through many sample handling steps, and out the back end, you know, we get very minute quantities of stuff that we can stick into the instrument and then try to get data from. In a perfect world, what we'd be able to do is take individual cells and completely characterize everything going on inside that cell at a given moment in time and how that cell responds to changes very rapidly or even over long periods of time, and get a full characterization of exactly what the cell is doing and what's going on. In my opinion, that's sort of the ultimate goal, is to have a complete characterization of all the protein components of a cell, exactly what they're doing, how they've been modified, how they're trafficking around inside the cell, and how they're making changes and responses to stimuli or mutations or what have you. I don't think we're probably going to be there in 5 years, but I think a lot of us in the mass spectrometry community have the same goal. That's really what we want to get to, is a complete characterization. There are proteins in cells that are at hundreds of thousands or millions of copies per cell, and then there are those that are present at less than one, right? If you have three cells, maybe this protein is present in one cell. And even proteins that are at such low level are critically important, in many cases, you know, the things that are the most important, because those are the things that turn on changes in protein expression or the things that are responding to stimuli. And so that's where I'd like to get to. I think that's where the mass spec community would like to get to. How long that will take, really, I don't know, but that would be the goal.
And on the same note, from the biological side, as it relates back to our ABA project, the idea that these plants have 30,000 proteins in them and we're able to look at, let's say, 5,000 at a time, and we narrow that down to the 50 that we think are actually changing with ABA, being able to narrow it down even more from there and take those 50 and really tease them apart individually and say, are there any of these 50 which are really critical to the drought resistance? Is there one or two that's really doing all of the heavy lifting and the other ones are just sort of regulated by those two? Mm-hmm. And I think from here, now that we have our list that we've put out in this publication, the idea is we've now distributed it to the entire scientific community and we said, here's what we found. Do your best with it. Mm-hmm. And publish what you can from it and tell us more about it. And I think that's one of the great things about the scientific community is we've now given them what we know, and hopefully they'll take that and run with it, as we will as well. And it's a nice little competition also as well to see, you know, who's going to come up with the next idea and who's going to be able to translate it maybe into the field first and who's going to be able to do the next step of it. And so I think that our goal as a lab is going to take these 50 proteins and to truly try to tease apart what they're all doing and hopefully find the next blockbuster thing and put out another paper or another 10 papers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a lot of other interesting, I mean, and there are other interesting things that can go on as well. So, for example, we've sampled a couple of time points of treatment with ABA. Now that we have this list, we can go to finer resolution of time points. So we can find out what's happening first, which leads to what happens next, and which leads to what happens next. And understanding the cascade of events that the plant goes through can give us some understanding about how these mechanisms talk to each other, you know, what mechanism might be common, treatment with ABA, other treatments, which things are going to be the best targets for looking at modifying these proteins and seeing how we can improve their responsiveness or attenuate their responsiveness. And along the same lines as what Kelly was saying, you know, we've given the list out to the community, and now we've made our findings available. You know, some of these proteins that are changing as a result of ABA treatment, those are going to be classes of proteins or even individual proteins that some labs are going to be really specialized in. They're going to be experts at this one protein or this one system. So they're going to pick up on those, and they're really going to hammer on those. Other labs might be experts in a different system or a different subclass of proteins, and they're going to pick up on those and hammer on those. So by publishing this way and distributing this list of changes that we've seen, other scientists are going to pick up on different aspects of our findings and really start to drill down on them and then find out a lot more information about them.
You can see these two people are so smart. Actually, I could probably go on sabbatical and the lab would do fine.
Does this lead to patents? Are all these plants that are going to be drought-resistant going to be patented?
One of the incredible things about University of Wisconsin is they really work hard to make sure that the discoveries that scientists such as Kelly and Greg and myself make are moved out into the real world. And one of the ways you do that is to commercialize and patent something so that a company will then use it and move it out there. And in fact, in my lab previously, I had a student who we developed a new technology that went on and formed a company, and it was commercialized and did extremely well. In this case, it may not be ready for the patenting part yet. Right now, we've just got a list of genes. And again, like Kelly and Greg said, we don't know yet which of those 50 will be the key player yet. And then the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, which is this nonprofit entity responsible for ensuring the intellectual property of the university is put out there, would then decide whether this is something they would like to patent and see if a company will use this in their breeding program or in their genetic engineering program. And it's really amazing. This university has such great talent in that other part of the world of commercializing. In addition to its great strength in basic research, it really has all these pieces that you only find at just a couple other places like Stanford and Johns Hopkins. But we are very unique in that aspect. Many of your listeners may not be aware of that.
Do you get to name some of the proteins and genes, the hormones and things? You get to...
Will there be a Sussman cabbage out there or a Klein cabbage?
Well, yeah, it's an unknown protein.
I guess you wouldn't want a Wilt cabbage, would you?
No.
Thank you for being with us and sharing the excitement of the plant world.
Thank you.
Our guests have been Michael Sussman, Gregory Barrett Wilt, and Kelly Klein. It's been fascinating and entertaining at the same time. Pleasure to have you with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll go behind the scenes for production of a new play involving a deaf actor and music. How do music and deafness combine? We'll find out next Sunday right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.